It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. It's a beautiful day outside in Anchorage, sunshine glistening off the snow, and that means that spring is coming, along with the deadline to apply for your permanent fund check. And then we know in the fall, the money shows up in the mail, or more probably just drops into your bank account. It's as regular as the seasons in Alaska, and something that we expect, just as a matter of course, the way we expect the warm weather to come as the sun comes up later and later in the evening this time of year. Well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? We're used to getting free money in the mail from the government, and it's sort of a basic part of our Alaskan culture. You go outside to other states, and people think that's kind of odd or even bizarre. And so it's something unique about Alaska that's worth looking at. And in fact, it used to be that there was kind of a sense that having this free money was somehow not right or immoral or something strange and suspicious about it. Well, that has turned around. Now there are people around the world looking at our permanent fund and saying, wow, maybe we should have one too. That seems like a pretty good idea. And they're looking at it from a bunch of different angles and for a bunch of different reasons. And that's going to be our topic today, the permanent fund model. What is it? How'd we get it? And why would people from other countries, other parts of the world want to know about it? I have four very distinguished guests today who are going to discuss this. Three Alaskans and one scholar from outside who has recently put together a book. And I'm going to introduce the rest of my guests in a few minutes. Dr. Carl Wiederquist is joining us by phone. He's in California right now, and he's the editor of the new book, Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend, Examining Its Suitability as a Model. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Wiederquist.
Hello. Yes, it's great to be here. Or virtually.
Virtually, by phone, yeah. You are based in Qatar in the Middle East as part of Georgetown University, and I'm just curious as to how the permanent fund in Alaska, on the other side of the world, became an interest for you.
Well, it was an interest long before I went to most of the expats there call it Qatar, but most Americans know it as Qatar. Military people tend to call it Qatar, but it's that small oil-rich Arabian Peninsula state that puts out Al Jazeera. Long before I went there, I was interested in it. And what's going on in Alaska is unique in two ways. Now, at least in one way, is that you've got an endowment, a permanent fund used to create interest, which is split between all the citizens. And the idea of an endowment paying a dividend is Alaska is the only place in the world that's doing it. And it used to be that Alaska was the only place in the world that was paying money to all of its citizens. But as of about a year ago, Iran has started doing it. I wouldn't pick Iran as a country I'd usually like to emulate, but they're actually emulating Alaska on this one.
Yeah, interesting.
I'm interested in the uniqueness of the Alaska model, the fact that it's obviously working, and it's also because it's putting into practice something that economists have been talking about for at least 70 years.
What do you mean? That's news to me.
Economists, for at least 70 years, when a guy named Stigler and a guy named Hayek in the 1940s started talking about this, has been gained steam in economics for a long time, and now it's getting discussed a lot in philosophy and political theory, is the idea that if the government wants to help people, it should give them money, and money with no strings attached. And that's exactly what people are doing in Alaska. Everybody gets it. All you have to do is be a resident. You don't have to do anything to get it. A lot of the things that government does are justified because people can't afford them. But they're often not things that people can't do for themselves. Like, certainly people can't build a highway system by themselves, so the government's going to do that. But many of the other things government does, if if everybody had some money, the government wouldn't need to do them. And it's in economic terms, it's much more efficient just to give people money. If that's what you care about, is having making people better off, and you want to do it efficiently, you give people money, and then they can get whatever it is that they want.
So that's a really interesting different way of looking at the permanent fund, because I think most Alaskans look at it as a political institution, a way of saving money, a way of avoiding the state wasting money, and the dividend as being a tool to sort of protect the permanent fund, give it a constituency. But what you're saying is that from the outside perspective, the dividend is really a bit more interesting in terms of how it affects the body politic or the public.
Well, interesting thing about government policies is that they don't have intentions because they're all voted on by many different people and they're influenced by many, many more different people. And I think that's why it's ridiculous to say is to talk about the importance of the founders and what they were thinking, because they were all thinking different things. And one of the motivations for the permanent fund was to save money. And one of the motivations for the dividend was to protect the permanent fund. Some people that voted for it for that reason But I would say most people who voted for it to keep Jay Hammond happy and get whatever he was trading for their votes on it. So if you're looking for intentions, that's probably the most popular intention of the permanent fund.
Right.
Or the permanent fund dividend when it was really started. Now, but it has many other intentions, and the this idea of taking a resource and selling it off to the private sector and giving everybody a share of the proceeds for it, I think is a great idea and very important. And I'd like to see many other resources given away. Many are given away in the name of jobs.
Right. But what other places around the world is it applicable? Obviously, you have to start out with having some money, right?
Well, It's applicable really all over the world. You see a fund like the permanent fund in a lot of places that have oil, and Alaska's permanent fund isn't even the largest. It's fifth or tenth? It's up there, but it's less than a tenth the size of the largest in the world, which in Norway has over a half a billion.
Half a trillion.
Abu Dhabi has over a half a billion in their fund.
I think it'd be
they
trillion.
They don't pay dividends to people.
Usually half a trillion rather than half a billion, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a big slip. Yeah, half a trillion. So lots and lots of money put into these funds.
So
it is possible to save without without giving the dividend.
Right. But in terms of if you go to a poor country, they're not going to be able to have a dividend, presumably.
Or maybe that's not true.
Really?
Because the difference between a resource-rich country and a resource-poor country is not in how many resources they have. It's whether or not they have the type of resources that the government usually sells rather than government usually gives away free. There's a lot of supposedly resource-poor countries where we're all going to vacation by the beaches, and the government gives those beaches away for free or very close to for free to international hotel chains that sell them to us. And we're there not so much for the hotel, but really for the beach. And the beach is just as much the people's as is Alaska's oil. The United States it first asserted ownership, the entire broadcast spectrum in the 1920s when people started using it. And then gave it away for free to corporations and has been giving more and more of it away. And it's worth trillions of dollars.
Hmm.
And corporations sell that back to us through subscriptions to cell phones or through watching advertising on radio and TV. They sell it back to us after the government gave them for free. And in exchange, they'll give a public service announcement at 5 o'clock in the morning on Sunday something like that.
Interesting. Except for public radio. Let's have an exception.
That's right.
We're going to get on to our other guests in just a minute, and I really appreciate your being with us. But I wanted to ask, did you, when you came into this project, you maybe didn't know as much about Alaska as you do now. What was your impression of the authors that you recruited from Alaska to work on the book and what their contributions to the scholarship was?
Oh, they've been great. We felt so lucky to get them involved because that gave us an insight that none of us had. The only one that had that got in the book that I had any interaction with before was Scott Goldsmith, who's one of the first people to realize the connection between the permanent fund dividend and what economists have been calling a negative income tax or a basic income. And he wrote a paper about it. We met at a conference, and between him and Greg Erickson and Cliff Groh, we really got Alaska perspective from people that knew the history. And for us to have tried to reproduce that from outside of Alaska without the inside knowledge that those three brought to it would have been extremely difficult. So they ended up, between the four of them, I think they wrote, between the three of them, I think they wrote six chapters. So they've, in two books, it's actually, a second book is going to come out later this year. It's going to be called Exporting the Alaska Model. And their contribution to those two books has been just extremely valuable.
Yes. Oh, great. And for listeners who want to find out about the book, you can find find it linked from our website, alaskapublic.org. The first volume, Alaska's Permanent Fund Dividend, Examining Its Suitability as a Model, is out now, and the other volume will be out later. And they are expensive books, but I'm sure they'll be available in our libraries as well. And the editor, the person who put all this together, is Carl Wiederquist, professor with Georgetown, and he's been with us from California. Thanks very much for being with us.
All right. Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
All right. Good. And my name is Charles Wolforth. The show is Hometown Alaska. Our topic is the Alaska Permanent Fund from a different perspective than you might be used to. You can join the show by calling 550-8433 or outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I'd like to introduce two more guests. We're going to have all three of the guests who contributed to the book with us today. In studio with me today is Cliff Groh, who is an attorney here in Anchorage, an author. He's been a journalist for a long time, as well as an attorney, and has also been involved in public policy. He was on the ground floor when the permanent fund dividend was created in 1982 and helped create that legislation. Cliff, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Charles. It's nice to be here.
And on the phone from Juneau is economist Greg Erickson, who also had a role in as a founding father of the permanent fund, working in the legislature and in Juneau, where he is knows more about the ins and outs of Alaska's finances than I think anyone alive. So I thank you very much for being with us, Greg.
I'm delighted to be here.
So since I've got both of you, and you both have a strong historical knowledge about the fund, I wanted to touch a little bit on what Dr. Wiederquist was saying, and I'll turn first to you, Greg. This idea of intent, it comes up all the time in discussion about the permanent fund. The permanent fund was meant to be this. The permanent fund was meant to be that. I have my own theories. I wrote a book with Dave Rose, who was the first executive director of the fund. My sense is that there really was a wide diversity of opinions about what the permanent fund was for when it came into an existence. Would you agree with that, Greg?
Oh, absolutely. But I think I would go even further to say that there was a kind of tacit agreement that we didn't really have to figure out what it was for, that the one overriding purpose, as stated by Elmer Rasmussen at the time, or actually very close to the time, was that it was there was a negative goal that everybody could agree on. They didn't want to have the current government, the current legislature, spend all of the oil riches. They wanted to save, set some aside for decision makers that came later.
And we did set some aside, but looking at the research and analysis you've done, we set aside actually a pretty small amount of our total resource wealth. How does that break down?
Well, as we showed in our book, in our chapters, Cliff and I, the total oil revenue since 1977, when the pipeline started up, has been worth about $103.5 billion. We've also collected about $15 billion through 2010 from other sources, but of that $103.5 billion that came from oil, About 18%, 19% went into the permanent fund. But we've done other kinds of savings and investment too. We have many billions in savings accounts outside the permanent fund. So, you know, I think particularly in recent years, as we've had this second bolus of oil money flow in, the legislature has actually done a pretty good job, I think, of saving and investing in. The attempt has been to try to get Alaska's economy weaned off of oil. Hasn't been very successful, but they've certainly tried to build up the infrastructure and put a lot of money into education, which is also a kind of investment. So, mm-hmm. I guess I'd say that it's varied over the years. Certainly, we could have put in a lot more, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and I believe we have about 19 billion in sort of ready reserves now that are outside the permanent fund. So
that's correct.
Yeah, let me turn to Cliff. Cliff, you were involved in the early 80s. There was a permanent fund dividend program that Governor Hammond had gotten into law, which would have essentially given more money to people who had lived here longer. That was struck down by the Alaska Supreme Court, and then United States Supreme Court, and then a backup dividend program was put into place, which is the program we have today, which is simply a flat sum for everybody in the state. And back on this intent concept, did you have what was the intent of the dividend? I mean, I know there are many ideas, but was there an overriding idea, do you think, in the Capitol?
Well, it tended to be about five or six that were discussed. I do want to stress that things look a lot different in Alaska than they do from Gutter or from Georgetown, in the sense, as I think people would generally understand. There was, as you said, an interest in creating here in Alaska a constituency for the permanent fund itself by creating the dividend, sort of a shield theory or a militant protectors, make the Alaskans the guardians of the fund. There was an interest some people had in stimulating the economy. There was also a powerful rhetoric of equity ownership. Hey, it's our oil, individuals should get a share. And so you'll note that when the unusual thing about permanent fund dividends is they tend to scramble conventional political calculations. You have people who are in some circles in American politics considered left-wing in favor of, hey, let's make sure everybody gets a share, even poorer people and less powerful people in the political realm, allied with people who think of themselves as more libertarian. Hey, we don't like the government, let's get money out of the government's hands. So dividends have always been a real strange creature. And I want to stress that they're different, although often confused in Alaska. The permanent fund dividend is different from the fund. They're often confused.
Right.
But the permanent fund is, of course, a public savings account of about $40 billion. The permanent fund dividend is a universal direct distribution plan from off the earnings of that fund. But you could have one without the other.
But the idea of creating a dividend as a basic income source, I think in his heart of hearts, I think Jay Hammond might have identified with that pretty well. But that wasn't really a selling point at that time at all.
No. And as you and I have discussed before, Charles, it would have killed it. Right. In Alaska, that would have been bad politics. And one of the people involved with the basic income guarantee movement that Professor Wiederquist was talking about that he's been involved with is a public official in Brazil who came and visited me. He and his wife are both public officials. And they want to talk about, hey, great, Cliff, you created a floor here in Alaska, a basic income. And like, we want to like think about bringing that to Brazil. And he said, that's now how people sold it or thought about it. I do think there were a few people thought of it that way, maybe a little bit. But Jay Hammond certainly, as a master politician, didn't push that as a basic selling point of the plan.
Didn't talk about it anyway.
Yeah.
I want to go to a caller now. Ray Metcalf is on the line from Anchorage. Ray, you have a quick question?
No, I was part of the legislature when all this was going on. And I think there's some misconceptions about how this all came about. And I was in the room when Terry Gardner, who was the Speaker of the House at the time, said, hey, I think we just ought to send everybody a check. And Jay turned around and he changed his mind and he decided he was for it. And we used a bill that he had introduced, and it got dramatically changed in the state Senate and sent over to the House, and it went through my committee. I was the chairman when it went through it. That was the second dividend program. The first one was thought up by Terry Gardner, and he took a bill that was introduced by Bill Miles that happened to be in the State Affairs Committee, and he rewrote it, and we passed it on out, and that's the bill that resulted in the, if you've been here longer, you get more, that Zobel took to court and got thrown out. And when that was thrown out, that's when we picked up that Hammond bill, and that was in the Senate. And it went through the Senate, and then it landed in my committee. I sat down with the chairman of the Finance Committee and said, what are you going to do with it? And I was in agreement with what his plans were for it at the time. But I was very busy with the marching orders for the investment strategy for the permanent fund at the time also. And so I happily passed, waved the bill through the committee so that the finance chairman could do what he planned to do with it, which was very much in line with what I'd have been agreeable to at the time. And the investment strategy was a bill that was, there were two bills in. There was a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate.
You know, Ray, this is interesting stuff, but I want to talk a little bit about more about the present and getting into a bit more detail than I really want to dig into on this. Do you want to do you have an overall point you want to wrap it up with?
Well, it was intended at that time to eventually be a fund that took over where oil left off. In other words, we all knew that Prudhoe Bay would sooner or later run dry, and that it was the intent at the time that the fund would be big enough by the time Prudhoe Bay ran dry that the income from the permanent fund could supplant the income that we had enjoyed from oil in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Let me throw that over to economist Greg Erickson. You've written a chapter in this new book about challenges in the first 30 years, and there's certainly been a lot of discussion about the use of the fund beyond dividends. Can you address that? Is there really any reality or likelihood of the fund being used as a source for funding government?
Oh, I think so. I don't think it's likely, or I don't think it's going to happen soon. But in fact, it already is being used for government, as we documented in that chapter that you just mentioned. There's roughly $300 million, as I recall, each year being taken out of the fund and used for things that used to be paid for by the general fund. So there's sort of been a quiet, kind of stealthy.
Give us some examples.
Well, for example, from the very beginning, the legislators didn't want to have people lose their welfare payments, their federal welfare payments, just because their income increased because of the fund, of the dividend. So they passed what they called the hold harmless provision, and now we take money from the permanent fund to pay the feds to allow us to keep people on Medicaid, for example. Prisoners' health care has been paid for out of the fund. We pay all the expenses of the Permanent Fund Corporation. Used to pay them out of the general fund, but those got switched. Whenever a lawyer here picks up a pen to give advice to the that is remotely related to the permanent fund, the money comes out of the dividend fund. And there's a lot of management expenses as well. So those are the sort of stealth expenses. And legislators are always trying to slip some more in. You know, attitudes have changed, though. Back in the 90s and certainly in the 80s, as Cliff in particular has documented in the history chapter, if you had a secret ballot in the legislature, and I bet Mr. Metcalf would agree with this, people would have voted to dip into that fund to use the money for government in an instant. They didn't have the ability to do that in public, but that's what their intention was.
Legislators, in other words.
Yeah, and there's this long history of overt efforts by Governor Murkowski, by Governor Cooper, and others to get a piece of that action for government.
So when you talk about the money that has been taken for use for things such as hold harmless and these other purposes, explain just quickly how the income from the fund is divided up, because there's a portion that's divided out for the dividends, and then there's another portion that's essentially available for spending by the legislature, except for the amounts you talked about, which are pretty small, it really has not been spent very much, right?
Well, you're right. If you look at the overall percentages, but if you look at if you add up the total that's been spent for government, it's over $1 billion easily since the program started. And had that gone into the fund as inflation proofing does, or had it been paid out to Alaskans, you'd have a different situation. Earnings on the fund are a complicated and frankly difficult to explain the sort of peculiar way in which it's all divided up. But essentially, it goes into a fund called an earnings reserve, and the dividend is established based on an average of earnings over the previous 5 years. It's 10.5% of the cumulative five-year earnings. So on average, it's just a little over 50% of the earnings get put into the dividend fund. But then money comes out of the dividend fund for a lot of these other purposes, mm-hmm. and what's left over gets mm-hmm. divided up among the people who apply, who are eligible. The rest of the money, part of it gets put back into the principal of the fund by inflation-proofing payments, and the other part goes into this big earnings reserve, which, in the peculiar way that the fund is set up, is really necessary to make sure that we have money to pay dividends in years when income is negative for the fund.
So if the stock market goes down, we can still pay the dividend. So it's really in most to the largest degree, it's been a dividend machine to produce dividends. It really hasn't had another purpose.
I think that's right.
Would you agree with that, Cliff?
I would. And if people want to have a system in which the permanent fund principal endows the budget, sometimes called the Cremo plan in Alaska after Anchorage attorney Roger Cremo, you need a way larger permanent fund, Charles. You need a permanent fund about five times larger, not so much $40 billion we have today, but more like $200 billion, just because the budget is large, and if you devoted all the income, you'd need, like I said, a much larger permanent fund to be able to finance the whole budget.
And the budget has really grown faster than the fund has, hasn't it?
It has grown a lot for a lot of different reasons, and that is one of the what I sometimes call the fiscal four, the Alaska four factors that are unusual here, one of them being that Alaska has high state spending relative to national mm-hmm. averages.
Well, you've studied politics and been involved in politics for a long time. The reality of ever using the permanent fund for anything other than dividends seems as far away as it has ever been. What would a politician have to do to come out and say, you know what, I think that education is more important. We really need to spend the permanent fund on that. Would that just be political suicide, and will that ever happen?
You'd need a bigger squeeze than you have today, and we've come close to it. There have been times when it looked like something might get voted on in the Alaska legislature is cast some votes and pass some things. Even asked, as you recall, and some of your listeners will recall, back in 1999, put an advisory vote on the ballot to try to reduce the dividend from what would otherwise be and put some of the money that otherwise go to permanent fund dividends into the budget.
Failed. 2006, it came within three votes in the Senate.
Right. There have been various attempts to do it. It has not worked. I think you need to have a real big squeeze and a widespread recognition that there was a big problem with public services before people would do that. Obviously, there's sort of a three-way fight in Alaska, at least three-way fight, which, as I said, permanent fund dividends scramble conventional political calculations. In a lot of states, Charles, in a lot of places, you have sort of fights between people who want more services, between people and the other side, people who don't want to pay more taxes. In Alaska, you have fights between people who want more services, people or don't want services reduced substantially, between people who don't want to pay more taxes, of which obviously Alaska has some of the lowest taxes in the world, and thirdly, between people who don't want permanent fund dividends reduced from what they would otherwise be under current law.
So is it kind of a Mexican standoff?
It has some odd effects here in Alaska, and people have talked about a couple different solutions to break it. toward the last few years of his life before he died in 2005, Governor Hammond was proposing having the individual income tax brought back and structured such that people would never have to pay a payment on the individual income tax larger than what the dividend would be in a year. Other people have talked about, including Greg Erickson, right on your line today, have talked about maybe just cashing out the permanent fund principle, distributing among all Alaskans and starting over. And other people talked about a variant of that, splitting up maybe half the permanent fund and making a balloon payment, as my
so
wife
everybody's going to get $30,000 in the mail.
Something like that, and then say, hey, now, folks, after this last big payment, we're going back to a regular relationship between the people and the government because the oil money has slowed down. I don't know when we'd ever get to that point, mm-hmm. but obviously the trend line in terms of the Prudhoe Bay curve goes only one way. The production's fallen for every year except one over more than the last 20 years.
Yeah. Let me turn to you, Greg, and we're going to take a break in a moment and let you go. But let me ask you this question. Dr. Wiederquist and his work and these other scholars have brought up the point of, well, the great thing about the permanent fund is it gives basic income. You know, they're much less interested in the savings aspect and seem to be more interested in the fact that it's producing this social floor where everybody gets a certain amount of income. If that's the case, well, why worry about it? Why not just leave it the way it is and say, well, we'll just pay for government out of other things?
Well, I think that might be a better solution than a lot of the other possible solutions, but there are downsides to it, and one of them is that people tend to stay here to get the dividend, or we have migrants are attracted by the dividend, and the economic activity of the created by the dividend attracts people. So we end up with more people in Alaska than the real economy makes sense of. So that's one problem. I think that there's too much focus on the relationship of the permanent fund to state spending and the state government. I think the real role of the permanent fund may well be that it cushions the economy of the state from some of the terrible stresses that would result if we suddenly had a collapse in oil prices right now. One other point, the equality of income in countries and states is very often linked with well-being. Places that have real high inequality tend to have authoritarian governments. They tend to have a lot of poverty and unhappiness. And I think that Alaska is the only state in the United States that hasn't gotten more unequal in wealth and income and it's the only state in the United States that has bucked that trend. And I think it's clearly a consequence of the dividend.
Yeah. Well, that's a
and
great.
I think that's good.
That's a great place to stop before our break. I want to thank you very much for being with me, Greg Erickson from Juneau. Greg's an economist and a distinguished person who has studied these issues for a long time, and we really value that you could be with us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We're going to go to a break and introduce another guest, and after the break, I'll also have those phone numbers so that you can get involved in our conversation. It's Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
Listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Our topic today is the Alaska Permanent Fund, especially the dividend that the Alaska Permanent Fund produces, its effect on our state, and its use as a model for people around the world thinking about having their own funds and their own dividends. If you'd like to join the conversation, we welcome your calls at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're calling from outside the Anchorage Bowl, you can call 888-353-5752, and it's toll-free. And we also read emails on the air at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And now I would like to welcome Professor Scott Goldsmith, who has joined us. Professor Goldsmith has written extensively on this subject and has been a guest before on the show and an old hand in talking about the permanent fund. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to see you again.
Scott, in this new book, and I also want to reintroduce my guest, Cliff Groh, who's also in the studio and is one of the folks who helped originate the permanent fund dividend as a legislative staff member in the 1980s. Scott, we were talking just a moment ago about income inequality and how the permanent fund has addressed that issue to some extent here in Alaska. I know you wrote a chapter for the new book looking at the social impacts of the permanent fund in Alaska, permanent fund dividend in Alaska. Could you talk about how, it seems like it's one check, it's usually around $1,000. Is it really that big a deal in terms of making income more equal in our state?
Well, I think its biggest impact is that it brings up the bottom end of the income distribution. And that's particularly important, of course, out in rural parts of the state where cash incomes are quite low. And beyond that, it's hard to use the standard economic measures to say that there's been a dramatic reduction in the distribution of income. But it's at that bottom end that it makes a big difference.
And when you say it's hard to, one of the things you start your chapter talking about is that there's a lack of research, a lack of hard information about the impact of the permanent fund in Alaska. And if you think about that, that's kind of amazing that we have a government program, which is one of the biggest factors in our entire economy. And there hasn't been extensive research to figure out some of the basic ways it affects our populace and our economic picture in Alaska. Do you have a feel for the reason why that's the case?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One is that we in Alaska tend not to analyze the impacts of our government spending and our social programs as a general matter of policy. Secondly, I think that there's a suspicion that if anybody studies the permanent fund or studies the dividend, it's because they want to do something to change it. And that makes people very uncomfortable from the get-go.
See no evil, hear no evil.
That's right. The less said, the better. And then I think from the point of view that the dividend is a distribution of an ownership share of a publicly owned resource, why should the government be concerned about what individuals do with their money? I think that's the third reason.
But as an academic, surely you're curious as to, one issue that's come up repeatedly, and it was just addressed briefly by Greg Erickson, is that giving away the money certainly must influence people in their decisions whether to come to Alaska or leave Alaska. I mean, we all know about the Pilgrim family who came and caused a ruckus up at the Wrangell St. Elias National Park, and specifically came because they would get dividends and could buy some property. Has anybody looked at the impacts on immigration and departure?
It's interesting in what people have looked at. No, I'm not aware of any studies that I would say would be worth looking at that had tried to analyze the population magnet effect of the dividend. But that's a good example, I think, of what we would call unintended consequences of the dividend. People don't tend to think of what the effects might be from the incentives that are established by the dividend. And of course, another incentive that might be there, similar to the population magnet, is just having on fertility, having more children.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. Of course.
Another, of course, is what it might do to the labor supply. You know, to the extent that people have higher incomes, they may choose not to work. A couple of interesting studies that I've looked at, and all of these studies really have been done by non-Alaskans. Interestingly enough. One was looking at the death rate, and they concluded that the death rate blipped up, took a little uptick right after the distribution of the dividends, although it fell later on. Maybe that was heart attacks when people got to see the size of the dividends. I don't know what the mechanism.
Or hard partying.
Another is that the increase in income associated with the dividends might have some positive effect on health outcomes, particularly of newborns.
Wow. Cliff, my other guest, Cliff Groh, is dying to say something. Cliff?
Yes. I want to say that the Pilgrims are sort of a common anecdote. You can use other anecdotes to show that some of the people brought here or attracted to Alaska, or at least induced to stay in Alaska by permanent fund dividends, are some better people that people think are nicer, like the Ionia therapeutic community on the Kenai Peninsula. So it's not just that you think of just, hey, it's the bad people that are attracted. I would also say...
But you could say that it's probably people who don't have high incomes, because the only people with low incomes would probably care about that
right.
amount of money.
But it's also true that a lot of different uses of the money has an effect of the oil money has an effect on people's decisions to live in Alaska. The fact that Alaska eliminated the individual income tax back in 1980 obviously made it more likely that a variety of people would want to claim Alaska more as their official residence and want to live here to try to avoid paying individual income tax.
Sure.
They would pay in other states that they would have otherwise paid in Alaska if it hadn't been repealed.
And along those same lines, I've got an email here from a listener who says, it was stated that Norway doesn't give any of its permanent fund back to the people. They provide cradle-to-grave quality health care at no-cost education all the way through graduate school. I think most Alaskans would trade their PFD check back for either one of those two in a minute. What do you think, Cliff?
Well, I gave a speech about Norway this morning. that's why I'm wearing a suit, gentlemen, here in the studio, to explain that.
I wondered.
Yes. And Norway has a whole bunch of different things going for it. One is it has a lot of taxes on income taxes and sales taxes on things other than oil, and actually most of its generous Nordic model of what the government provides is mostly financed by taxes or money that does not come from oil production. Oil production pays for part of it, but the majority of it is paid for the expensive other things people buy in terms of sales taxes and income taxes there. So Norway has a different model. There may be some things to learn from the Norwegian experience. They have a whole bunch bigger permanent fund than we do. It's on the order of 12 times larger or more. But it's I would say that there are a lot of benefits in Norway. They mostly come from the other taxes that don't have to do with oil production.
But it brings back this original point that Dr. Wiederquist made in talking about, well, the best way to give out government benefits is just give people the money and let them decide. And I guess in Norway they feel no, it's actually better to do things that are of great public benefit. Now, when we look at how the permanent fund is spent, and maybe I'll turn back to you, Scott Goldsmith, on this. I mean, we know that people aren't necessarily spending it all on education. A few years ago, there was an ad on the radio where people said, the guy said, don't spend your money on a college education for your kid. You'll learn much more going to Hawaii. And we all know that in many kids are not there. Their permanent fund checks are some are probably used for necessary things. Some are saved and some are squandered. Have you looked at how the checks are actually spent?
I think the most interesting thing that we don't know about the how the dividends are spent is how the children's dividends are spent. Who makes the decision and where that money goes? In talking to my students, it sort of comes down 50-50. You know, about half of them, when they were young, had the opportunity to decide themselves how the money was spent. And for the other, about 50%, their parents decided what to do with that money, either to put it aside in savings or to spend it on the benefit of the whole family, basically.
Mm-hmm. And we've made a little bit of progress, and we now have the pick, click, give thing, where we at least put a little bit of public good sort of on the table that people can think about, but it's still very much a thing that you decide for yourself. I want to ask Cliff a question about that, but first make sure that listeners have the phone number if you want to get involved in our conversation, 550-8433. We've got a couple of permanent fund experts here, and it is your money, as we've been saying. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. My guests are Scott Goldsmith, a professor at the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and Cliff Groh, a writer, political observer, and attorney here in Anchorage. Cliff, you were there when the dividend was created. It's always struck me, just giving a personal opinion, that that it would have been such a big social impact if the children's dividends had been put into a trust that could not be spent until they became adults. What was the reasoning that went into just letting their parents spend it however they liked?
Well, there was a largely flowed from the effect of a man I worked with closely, who's already been mentioned in this radio show, Terry Gardner. At that point in 1982, the former Speaker of the House, a very sharp and aggressive legislator, still alive, unlike many of the people who were involved in the creation of the Permanent Fund and the Permanent Fund dividend. And he thought of himself as a good father. And it was sort of a trade for him. He was a negotiator involved in this, and he traded away some other things in part to really hang on to that immediate disbursement to parents and guardians of the children's dividends. And he thought that parents would use the money wisely as opposed to the system that was otherwise talked about, which was holding money to their 18, which would involve the creation of a complicated bureaucracy. And people also wondered what effects it would have if the kids got the money at 18. So there's a major underground philosophical discussion that occurred in 1982 that was not widely discussed, but had big effects, I agree.
What do you think? I mean, do you think that it would have been better to have done it the other way?
It's hard to call. It's not, you don't know what would have happened the other way. It's obviously had a more immediate economic impact to have the immediate disbursement. It's hard to call. And maybe, like I said, you could have tried to do it in some sort of jiggered way to get mm-hmm. to do part of both.
Looking at the history of the dividend, which I and the permanent fund itself, which I know you've studied, there was a comment made earlier that other funds around the world haven't needed a dividend in order to avoid being wasted. Maybe Alaska didn't need the dividend. And one of the strong arguments that Jay Hammond always made was this was a way of assuring constituency so Alaskans would protect the dividend. On the other hand, in the early years, there were some significant attacks on the fund. And some belief that it should be spent in ways that we now would sort of be horrified by. Do you think we'd still have the fund if we hadn't had a dividend, and has it performed that function?
It's helped protect it, and I guess that this partly goes to the more individualistic way of life in Alaska. That there's, especially when the time the permanent fund dividend was created, and the permanent fund were created in the 70s and the 80s, there was more of a philosophy in Alaska that people would come here and a number of them wanted to make money and move back somewhere else. And my recent study of Norway, like I said, I gave a speech about Norway this morning, has reminded me that there's a more communitarian spirit in some other places that have gotten some money. And so it's a lot about what you think alternatives are. Maybe some people would say that Alaska's handling the oil money doesn't look so good compared to Norway's. But then again, if you compare us to Nigeria, Charles, we're golden.
We're somewhere in the middle, right? Maybe we get a C. I want to go to a caller now. Caroline is calling from Anchorage, I think, on the issue of people being retained by the dividend, people avoiding leaving because they get the dividend. Caroline?
Well, I was wondering, one group we hadn't spoken about were seniors. And also, to add to that, what about folks that are able to stay in the bush? That would be another area. Again, primarily seniors. One thing that you mentioned, the personal income tax, and when I moved here in 67, there was a personal income tax, but you could deduct it from your federal tax if you itemized. So, you know, many people were very sad to see the personal income tax go, because you don't pay attention to what's going on in Juneau as much if you don't have skin in the game. The only time I think people really pay attention is when someone's trying to crack open the goodie box to spend it. And I never thought I'd agree with Elmer Rasmussen on much, but I definitely agree with him that it needed to be saved for other leaders, because the first 900 million that came in from the first lease sales evaporated within a year and a half. And I think people were so appalled that we did not adopt what Norway has, which is they help develop the fields. And they only lease. They don't give 30-year leases. They only license for a short time. And they are cooperating with the industry, and the industry cooperates with them, of course, because they are holding onto the resource and developing it themselves along with the industry.
Yeah, and we've done
so
a whole
many differences with how Norway does things, but I don't think we trusted our leaders at that time to have set up something like that, which is really sad.
Well, I think that's true, and it's a complicated historical story, and I thank you for your comments. And, you know, turning to you, Scott Goldsmith, it seems to me that there's a big factor here that we haven't really discussed, which is that this infusion of money into the Alaska economy every October must create more economic activity. And if we're to go away at this point, wouldn't that be quite a blow to our economic livelihood, or is it not that big a deal?
Economists would say that the impact is not concentrated in the latter part of the year, because after 30 years, Alaskans have come to expect that they'll get a dividend every year, and they have a fairly good idea of what the size of it will be. You've said that it's generally about $1,000, and so people take that the receipt of that income into account when they're making their consumption decisions throughout the year.
So they just roll it into the family budget.
So they roll it into the family budget. Now, on the other hand, every business in town wants to get a piece of that check when it comes out. So that's why you see all the advertisements and all the special deals. And so that does tend to draw the money out into the economy in the last quarter of the year. Of course, at the same time as the Christmas season, mm-hmm. and that helps as well. Yes, if that went away, it certainly would have a detrimental effect on the economy. You're talking about $700-800 million hitting the economy, and it's all discretionary income, pretty mm-hmm. much, and that means it's available to spend on anything. So it would have a sizable impact.
How does it stack up with other industries in Alaska in terms of the amount of sort of basic money it brings into our economy?
Yeah, well, $700 million, it's considerably less than the payroll of the petroleum industry, but it's considerably more than the payroll of the mining industry. And it probably is on the same order of magnitude as the payroll of the tourism industry. Now, if you look at what seniors or retirees bring into the state, it's considerably less, although we don't tend to think of the seniors as an economic driver.
Mm-hmm. When you got into this project working with Dr. Wiederquist and the other scholars from outside Alaska in looking at Alaska as a model that could be exported, did you find any misconceptions or expectations from their point of view that needed to be corrected? I know when I've been outside, sometimes I hear the permanent fund talked about as sort of a panacea that is an object of perfection, which I think that it's not. It obviously was put together a little bit by committee and has its flaws. What was your reaction, or what things were you surprised to hear about from them?
Well, the most surprising thing, and I think you've talked about this already in the first part of your program, was that non-Alaskans who are drawn to studying the fund tend to concentrate on the basic income idea. That's really what's unique about the fund, and that's what they would like to transfer to other locations. Whereas in Alaska, I think we tend to think of the dividend not as a distribution mechanism to make the income distribution more equitable, but rather simply as a distribution of our share of the wealth.
Mm-hmm. And I think it affects us when Alaska is small enough in population, but if you break down Alaska, it's actually quite diverse. And for some people, it might be a very big deal, say in rural Alaska, whereas in urban Alaska, it might mean, I'll buy a slightly better car, or I'll be able to pay off some bills a little quicker. Is that true?
Well, that's true, both because of the fact that the same amount goes to people of all income levels, but also the fact that it's taxable, and so people who have significant other income, we share maybe $150 million of that dividend total with the federal government when we pay our federal taxes at the end of the year.
Oh,
so we don't get to keep it all.
I see. We get $700 million from the state. We give $150 million of that back to the feds.
Something like that.
Yeah. Cliff, there's been some discussion recently about social investing and divesting from, I think it's Iran with their nuclear ambitions. And in the past, there's been a lot of resistance. There's this sense that there's something about the I don't think we even divested during the apartheid issue. culturally, how do you see, you know, it seems like there's a sort of sacredness about the permanent fund where we don't want to do anything with it that would break a consensus.
I tend to think that there is a single-minded focus on generating income from the permanent fund, and there's just, and then obviously most of it, as we discussed before, is used to pay either pay dividends or to go back into the permanent fund principle itself to protect against inflation. And I do think that, as with a lot of the questions we've discussed here throughout this hour, a lot depends what the alternatives are. If you think that the if we didn't have a permanent fund dividend, we'd have much better schools and would make our students much better educated and more competitive in the worldwide economy, then hey, you might say, hey, I'll give up my dividend for that. At least maybe some parents would. On the other hand, if you thought, hey, if I don't have a permanent fund dividend, it'll be used to build a big dam, which will be maybe blown up the day that it's completed just to get the construction jobs, you'd be less of a fan of it. So a lot depends what you think the alternatives are and how the money would be used otherwise.
Right. Well, having had been fortunate enough to talk to both Governor Hammond and Governor Hickel about this in pretty good depth, and both were sort of fighting for the future of Alaska back right. in the late 70s, you know, Governor Hammond believed that these resources really belong to us individually and should be distributed to us. And that was a sort of philosophical basic idea he had. Governor Hickel believed that these resources belong to us collectively and should be used for large infrastructure investments. And that would be the sort of the legacy of this money. And those are investments too, right? You build right. a big dam, you build a big road or whatever it is you invest in, or even education. Do you think that Hammond won this argument?
A lot of it, although, as we've said before, less than 20% of the oil money ever went into the permanent fund. And in terms of the automatic constitutionally required deposits, it's only about 10% of the oil money that's gone into the permanent fund. The legislature's appropriated some special appropriations when there was a lot of money on the table. So there's been a lot of money spent on infrastructure in Alaska and on state employees' salaries and on a whole bunch of other things.
Right. So you can't just take this 18% out and talk about that as being the one sort of philosophical decision that we made.
Right.
Yeah.
We made a number of them.
It's true.
But don't you think it redressed what otherwise would have been an imbalance?
Well, that was certainly what I thought at the time. that one of the big concerns in 1982 that motivated me and some other people who were working on it were that there was a whole bunch of push in the early 80s to have the oil money go to Alaskans in ways that involved higher salaries or more construction contracts. And the dividends were a way to try to, as Scott said, redress that imbalance.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it's been a great discussion. We could go on at more length. I don't know if the listeners will go with us, but I would enjoy it. I want to thank my guest. Carl Wiederquist was on at the beginning, along with Greg Erickson. Cliff Groh has been with us for the whole hour. Professor Scott Goldsmith is with us. It's been fascinating, and I hope you've enjoyed it too and learned something. There's a lot more to learn on the website at alaskapublic.org. We've got a lot of links there, and some good books have been published on the subject. Next week on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy will talk about the future of Port McKenzie with Port Director Mark Van Dongen. And our show is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the president of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.